All right, so welcome everybody to the last segment of Jewish history. It was an interesting journey. I must say it was a little bit different to the first one. It was much more factual, which was, for me, actually going a little bit out of my box. I enjoy more like theory and philosophy and Jewish philosophy. But this was definitely interesting, and I myself definitely gained a lot from it. I've learned a lot of things that I didn't know, because as I said in the onset, I actually don't know so much too much history, so I had to use what other people know, and it was definitely very insightful to know what happened around when, and gives us a lot of perspective. So, since we're in the last week, we're going to have to cover quite a bit, which will mean that we're going to have to skip out quite a bit. So, last week, so just before we begin, so this is the final week of the series. Next week, to remind everybody, is the SIM card program. Monday night, the 11th, Wednesday night, the 13th, various programs as preparation for Rosh Hashanah. So, if you're in town, come along. So, last week, we discussed from the year 1000, talking about Common Era, till around the year 1650, which was not a very good period. Crusades, Spanish Inquisition, blood libels, pogroms, primarily persecution from Christians, mostly based on religious, for religious hate, religious reasons. A lot of nonsense was believed, as we discussed last week. But after around this period, after the Spanish Inquisition, something we didn't discuss last week, the Jews in Poland, which we're not going to discuss now, but there was a very good period for the Jews in Poland, which was ended by a massacre from Ukraine, famous massacres that took place, terrible, terrible stuff. So the Jews are in an incredible low at this point. Spanish Inquisition just happened, as we discussed last week. Spain was a haven for the Jewish people, was sort of a golden age for the Jewish people, and now they were sort of crushed. So where did they go? So around half the Jews were in the Ottoman Empire, Israel, Turkey, the Middle East, and the other half was in Europe. Right. I mean, obviously there were Jews everywhere, but this was the most of the Jewish population were in these places. So let's talk a little bit about the Jews in the Ottoman Empire, in Turkey and in Israel, and that will bring us to discuss a very high point in Jewish history and a very low point in Jewish history, all actually roughly around the same time. So from the year 638, which is around 8 years after Muhammad passed away, Israel was under Muslim rule, except for the years of the Crusades, which didn't last very long. Generally speaking, it was under a Muslim rule, and that lasted all the way till after the First World War, where it fell under the British rule. Right. From the year 1516. It was under the Turks. Now, as we discussed last week, the Turks were pretty good for the Jews. As we said, there was one of the sultans of Turkey said that Spain has given us their treasure. In other words, they weren't smart. They expelled all the Jews, and the Jews came to us. And as the Ottoman Empire expanded, they came to Israel. And in fact, if you were in Israel and you saw around the old city, there's a wall. Who built that wall? A guy by the name of Suleiman, or however you pronounce it, basically Solomon in their language, and he built the walls around the old city, which are there till today. which was fascinating. His name was similar to Solomon. Solomon, King Solomon, being the one who built the first temple. But either way, he built the walls around the old city, which are the walls that we have, because the original walls were destroyed. The walls which were there from the temple times are not around today. There are remnants of it. You could see remainders of those walls, but the main walls that we have today are walls from the Turks who built it. It was at that time that the Jewish people started to immigrate to Israel. And interestingly, especially to the city of Tzvas, which is in the north of Israel, in less than 100 years, the population grew into more than 10,000 Jews in the city of Tzvas, which is quite big for those times. And in the city of Tzvas, many great things happened over there, which are very important to understand. So there was a great sage by the name of Rabbi Yosef Kairoy, who originally lived in Spain. He was a Sephardi, and he was expelled from Spain with the rest of the Jews. And eventually, he made it to Tzvas. And it was there that he did one of the most important things that ever happened in Jewish history, and that is that he wrote the Jewish Code of Law, we know as the Shulchan Aruch. At around the same time, there lived a person in Poland by the name of Rabbi Moshe Isserlish, who was known as the Rambo, who was an Ashkenazi. And he wrote footnotes on the Shulchan Aruch, where he argued with the Sephardi halachic authority. He ruled like the Ashkenazim held, right? Until today, that is what makes up the Shulchan Aruch, the Jewish code of law written by Rabbi Yosef Kairoy, and the footnotes written by the Rambam. And that is what's learned as one of the primary books of law in Judaism. Obviously, there are commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, and you know, nothing's that simple in Judaism. You can't just have a book of law and everything's going to be simple. But but that's the basis where we go to know what to do. So that's pretty significant, and that happened in the city of Tzvas. Perhaps what Tzvas is the most famous for, until today, if you go there, you can still see this idea there, is the growth of Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, what we know today as Kabbalah. Now, what is Kabbalah? Right, it's one of these words that like are thrown around a lot. You know, there's a lot of Kabbalah movements, and right, it's important to discuss what exactly is real Kabbalah and what isn't. Right, so what's important to understand is that Kabbalah is a part of Torah. It was given to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai. It's the part of Torah which is mysticism, the deeper aspects of Torah, the spiritual aspects of Torah, which discuss heavenly spheres, heavenly worlds, angels, things about God, the greatness of God. And it was given to Moshe Rabbeinu together with the entire Torah, just like everything was given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Mount Sinai. However, since it's so deep and so complicated and so complex and so difficult to understand, and also a little bit dangerous as well, because if you misunderstand it, you can come to very bad mistakes. Therefore, it wasn't taught to the masses. It was given over to a very select few people in every generation who learned it and passed it on to another very few select people. One of the most famous people being Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right, who we commemorate his Yahrzeit on Lag BaOmer, right, where he authored the Zohar being like the book of Kabbalah. Everything that came afterwards is all based, or most of it is based, on the Zohar. But again, even after the Zohar was written, it's a very difficult book to understand. If you open up the Zohar, it's almost impossible to understand what's going on over there. You needed to be a great sage to really decode and to understand what was going on over there. Right. However, just before we go on, there's an important point to emphasize here, and the reason why I mention this, is that it's a part of Torah. And therefore, any movement which separates Kabbalah from Jewish observance is not legitimate. In other words, you can't have Jewish mysticism without you can learn it, but you can't believe in it as a separate entity from the Torah. You can't make it into a thing of itself. Kabbalah. Let's study Kabbalah and nothing else about Judaism. It doesn't work that way. Kabbalah is a part of Torah, and it's holy, and it's based on the Zohar, and a part of the entire Torah, and therefore you need to take it all together. You cannot separate the two. Right? Therefore, generally speaking, whenever you see a movement like it has the name Kabbalah in it, you just have to check it out, what it is. Right? Is it a proper Jewish movement rooted in Torah and legitimate, and then it's good? Or is it just is it totally distorted? That's a very important point to mention. But where Kabbalah, or the learning of mysticism, grew was in the city of Tzfas. There was a Kabbalist by the name of Rabbi Moshe Kodavero, known as the Ramak. Ramak is an acronym for Rabbi Moshe Kodavero. He expounded and explained the Zohar. And that's when a huge growth in the study of Kabbalah started. So we're talking about now around 1534 of the Common Era, right? After the Ramak, in fact, the day that the Ramak was buried, arrived a new Kabbalist on the scene. And his name was the Arizal. He actually came from Jerusalem to Tzfas. The Arizal is known as the Kabbalist. And most of Kabbalah today, most of what is based on Kabbalah today, is based on the Kabbalah of the Arizal. Arizal, his name was Rabbi Isaac Luria, who again was born in the year 1534. And what's fascinating about the Arizal is we actually only know about 2 years of his lifetime. We know about 2 years of his life. He died very young, something like at age 32 or something. And we know about 2 years of his lifetime in the city of Tzfas. And from those 2 years, he had an unbelievable impact on Judaism, which is felt till today. One of the things about the emphasis of the Kabbalist of Tzfas, because it was a whole like movement of these Kabbalists, was the concept of Shabbos, or emphasizing the mysticism of Shabbos. Obviously, Shabbos is a mitzvah in the Torah, but emphasizing the spirituality of Shabbos. And the whole concept of Kabbalah Shabbos, Kabbalat Shabbat, going out and greeting the Shabbos, the way we have it today, in the Siddur, saying chapters of Tehillim and Lechadoidi, were all put together by the Kabbalists of Tzfas. There was a whole ceremony to go out into the fields and welcome the Shabbat. All of this was done in the spirit of mysticism and understanding the deep aspects of Shabbat. So again, this was an amazing time, if you think about it. At that time, there was great Jews who lived then, great Kabbalists, and it was just this sort of spiritual reality living in the city of Tzfas. And as I say, if you go there till today, you sort of feel Tzfas is a different type of city. It's a very mystical type of type of place. However, with the rise of Kabbalah came something else, which one can say, I don't know if it's a result, in other words, Kabbalah is a good thing, but it happened in that context. In the late 1600s, there was an extremely tragic event that happened, which shook up the entire Jewish nation. The Jewish people at that time were in a very big low, as I mentioned before, both physically and the Spanish Inquisition, massacres, terrible, terrible things, Cossacks. And, you know, when things can't get any worse. When things can't get any worse, the next step is that it gets better, right? And the anticipation, what you expect, the expectation is for some sort of redemption, or maybe even Messiah, Mashiach to come. And Jews were sort of like hoping for this. In other words, we're so low, it's so bad now, you know, what can come next should be the redemption through Mashiach. There was a man by the name of Shabtai Tzvi, born in the year 1626. He was born in Turkey, who called himself a Kabbalist. And again, putting this in the context that this was at the time when learning Kabbalah was on the rise. And by the age of 20, he was called a Chacham, which in Sephardi terminology, that's like crowning someone as like a very distinguished, great scholar and rabbi. But soon later, he was banished from his town because he started doing very deeply disturbing things, and people started looking at him like he was a total lunatic. Eventually, he made it to Israel, where he met a person by the name of Nathan. And this Nathan convinced him that he's the Messiah. Convinced Shabtai Tzvi that he's the Messiah, he's Mashiach. And this began to spread rapidly amongst the entire Jewish nation. Now, not everyone was convinced, but even in Europe, there are diaries written at the time of people saying that everyone was packing things, selling their property, literally expecting this man, Shabtai Tzvi, to bring Mashiach. And there were some Torah scholars who were swept up as well. However, most were against him. Most saw through him. And yeah.
He filled the specification of the Messiah. You mentioned in another section that there were some specifications.
Yeah.
Did he?
No, he didn't. Not yet. They were expecting him to. In other words, he was going to. They were expecting him. Okay, now he's going to meet. Now he's going to meet these specifications. Now, as I said, this was a lot of Jews. A lot of Jews were swept up in this, and Shabtai Tzvi believed it himself. He didn't lie to everybody. He believed it himself, and he went to the Sultan of Turkey and demanded that he should be recognized as the Messiah and Israel should be given to him. Obviously, he didn't buy this nonsense and threw him into jail. And he threatened him that he's going to torture him to death unless he converts to Islam. That's exactly what happened. He converted to Islam. And talking about, having a crash landing, right? When Shabtai Tzvi converted to Islam, the Jewish people had a serious slap in their face. A lot of Jews had believed in him that he was the Messiah. And obviously, a person which converts to another religion is definitely not the one, right? There was fringe group of Jews that still went along with him, but again, most of them obviously totally abandoned the whole idea, but it was a terrible, terrible, tragic event.
But the circumstances in that case obviously was done under duress, and if you don't do it, we're going to kill you. Is that not factored in? That
the Messiah, we would expect that somebody who's Mashiach would be ready to give up their life and not want to convert to another religion.
Is that an expectation of Jewish people, that in that particular circumstance you should give up your life?
Yeah, interesting question. Islam, it depends what it is. It's interesting that in the time of the Rambam, at the time of the Rambam, there were forced conversions of Jews from the Almohads in Spain to Islam, and they were forcing Jews to declare that Muhammad is a prophet. And many Jews were giving up their life. And the Rambam wrote a letter called the Geras Hashmad, saying that the Jews don't have to, because there's no real... I mean, it's wrong, Muhammad is not a true prophet, but it's not considered idolatry to believe that, right? Converting to Islam, would one be obligated to give up their life for that? It seems like from the Rambam, maybe not. But the fact that he had to, and the fact that he did, was an obvious sign that he wasn't the Messiah, he wasn't Mashiach. Mashiach should have been the one to conquer Eretz Yisrael and give it back to us, not one to be forced to convert to a different religion, right? So that was a terrible, terrible, terrible event. And one of the aftermaths of that, one of the results of that event, was that people became very wary of anybody that came and claimed they were a Kabbalist, or they studied Kabbalah, or they were bringing some sort of different dimension to Judaism. People became very, very wary. There was a great Kabbalist by the name of the Ramchal, who wrote a book called Mesilas Yesharim. He was almost hunted down, not physically, but spiritually banished by a lot of sages because they were very wary of these type of people who came and brought mysticism and all those type of things. They thought that this is going to be another false Messiah, right? Where the aftermath of this was felt the most was a movement which started not so long afterwards. We're talking about... Shabtai Tzvi was claimed to be Mashiach in the year 1648. In the year in 1698, we're going to go back a little bit, but this one just to explain in this context, the Baal Shem Tov was born, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. Yeah, and his birthday happens to be the Shabbos, right? The 18th of Elul. Yeah, 18th of Elul, and he started a movement called the Hasidic movement, which is known today as the Hasidic movement. Just a little bit of history about him. So he was orphaned at a very young age, and he became connected to a group of hidden righteous people who were sort of going around disguising themselves, didn't reveal the true identity, sort of secretly helping out Jews, both physically and spiritually. And he became a great, great person, a great spiritual person, a great mystic. And he set himself a mission to revive the spirit of the Jewish people, especially where he was. He was in Europe, in Russia. And he, because again, the Jewish people were in an incredible low at the time, especially after the whole Shabtai Tzvi story, right? They were very disillusioned. And he taught a philosophy which the purpose of it was to uplift the Jewish people. It emphasized that even the action of simple Jews mattered, because in those days there was a huge split between the scholars and the simple Jew. There were those who were great scholars, but then there were people who were totally illiterate and didn't know how to learn anything. And he sort of elevated them and showed how their actions are also precious. He emphasized the concept that God is to be found in everything. He emphasized the concept of prayer, of joy. That whole sort of spiritual aspect of Judaism, the Baal Shem Tov sort of tried to inject into the Jewish people. And after he passed away, the Hasidic movement continued by his disciple called the Maggid of Mizritch. After the Maggid of Mizritch passed away, it sort of split into various sects. So you had, for example, you had Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Alter Rebbe, whose birthday is also the Shabbos, who started the Chabad movement. You had, for example, Rav Nachman of Breslov, started the Breslov movement. But it's all movements, and nowadays you have, you know, you have many movements of Hasidim, which are actually called in the name of their cities where they originated from. So you have like Ger, you have Kotsk, you have Belz, all named after various cities in Europe where they originated from. And they're all sort of branches of this revolution of the Baal Shem Tov called the Hasidic movement. Why do I mention this now? Because this movement was met with great opposition. And great opposition, most of the people who opposed it with the right intentions. They didn't have any wrong intentions by opposing it. They opposed it because they were very wary of this new movement. Again, it came not so long after the whole Shabtai Tzvi story. And they were very wary of anything that was sort of deviating from normative Judaism. Right? And of course, like everything, like every group, there are those who are only there to make trouble. And there were those who made up lies about the Hasidim. But for the most part, there were great people who opposed Hasidus. The greatest of them being a very great sage, an incredible sage, by the name of the Vilna Goin, who lived at the time, at the same time as the Alter Rebbe. And he was a very, very great sage, one of the greatest sages in modern history, who wrote commentaries on many, on Talmud, on Shulchan Aruch, recognized by all Jews as one of the greatest sages. And he opposed the Hasidic movement because he was very wary of it. However, after a while, it became more mainstream. What I mean by that is not everybody became Hasidim, but it became more accepted. A mere few generations later, after the Vilna Goin, the leaders of both sects, which were called the Hasidim and the opponents to the Hasidim, worked together. They worked together to strengthen Judaism. They worked together to oppose forces from the outside who were persecuting the Jewish people. And today, Hasidus is a part of Torah. Everyone, to some degree, you know, learns that Hasidus is very, very large. There's many parts of Hasidus, and it's much more mainstream and much more accepted.
How is Hasidim
So it's a certain, like everything, it's a certain path in Judaism. So it's a path which, again, emphasizes joy, emphasizes prayer, emphasizes the spiritual aspect of Judaism.
My understanding of the word Hasidic is someone ultra-religious.
That's the way it's used today. But it's not really a true translation. There are many ultra-Orthodox Jews who are non-Hasidic.
Okay, so that's not
the context. The non-Jewish world uses the word Hasidic like to describe someone which keeps Shabbos. Like, right. There's no connection there. Yeah, it's a path. It's a path in serving God. Yeah.
Was it also part of the Torah, same as Kabbalah?
So it's all based on Kabbalah. Yeah. The learning of Hasidus is is based on Kabbalah. But again, as I said, these are all different paths in Judaism, whether someone subscribes to that movement, whether they don't, each way is legitimate, and each way has their great sages which they follow, right? But although there was great opposition to Hasidus at the beginning, and as I said, a lot of it for the right reasons, for the right intentions, but after a while, it was sort of proven that this is not a sect which is deviating from Judaism, rather it's just another path within normative Judaism.
Excuse me, why is Kabbalah called Kabbalah?
The word Kabbalah means tradition. So it's sort of a tradition passed down from Moses and onwards. Yeah.
So my question is similar. So the word Hasidim, comes from, what's the root?
So that's interesting. Why are Hasidim called Hasidim? So actually it was the opponents who gave them that name. Hasidim, chassid, is a terminology used in the Talmud already. It means someone who's very pious. The opponents to Hasidim sort of chose that name to laugh at them almost, like the pious ones, the ones who... Yeah, the things that people who think that they're very pious, but that name sort of stuck, and they were called Hasidim. So the singular is Hasid, and the plural is Hasidim.
I thought the term was like to go beyond.
Yeah, so the Talmud says, what's the definition of a pious person? Someone who goes beyond the letter of the law, but that's not the literal meaning of it. The literal meaning is pious. Like that. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So that was just in continuation of the rise of Kabbalah. Yeah. The date of birth is the 18th of Elul. In the year 1698. The Hebrew year of Nachas, yeah. Okay. Going back a little bit, we have to go through a few things quickly here. So we're in a stage of history now which is called by many the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, where unlike what we discussed last week, there was a lot of religious fervor going on in the world. In the Age of Enlightenment, which is from 1650 and onwards, started a new age where people moved away from religion and started becoming more secular and sort of laughed at religion and started emphasizing more humanism and secularism and individualism. And we see the effect of this till today, the concept of liberal democracy and all these things comes as a result. But for Jews, on the one hand, it had a positive outcome. On the other hand, it had a negative outcome. Now, this, what we're mainly talking about now, is Western Europe. So Western Europe. Eastern Europe and Russia, that's a whole other story, and we'll discuss that soon. But in Eastern Europe, it became much more better for the Jews physically. And this happened, again, because of this sort of, secularist outlook, once they lost their religious fervor, so there was no real reason to sort of be against the Jews. And there were no more pogroms anymore, and there was no more anti-Semitic attacks, and the Jews were allowed to become citizens in many countries, and it became economically very successful. And one of the people who did this, interestingly enough, was a person by the name of Napoleon. Napoleon was a fascinating character who almost conquered the whole Europe. And he liberated the Jews from the ghettos, and he sort of pushed forward this agenda of liberating the Jews, and giving them equal rights. However, his agenda wasn't that the Jews should remain Jews. He sort of said he wanted the Jews to assimilate. There are many interesting conversations recorded between Napoleon and the rabbis, how to assimilate the Jews. In fact, he suggested that one-third of the Jews should marry out. He wanted the Jews to sort of become a part of society. He wanted to sort of cure this problem.
He gave them the surnames. They didn't have surnames.
That's right. Yeah. Throughout Western Europe, there's an estimate that about 250,000 Jews converted to Christianity during that time, and countless others assimilated into Europe culture. In Western Europe, started the Reform movement, which we're not going to get into now. But again, the whole concept of sort of assimilating into the culture of the time, and that's when it started sort of the split between Orthodox Jewry and Reform Jewry, and which really, if we skip ahead a little bit, when the Jews went to America, those were the Jews who went to America. In other words, the foundation of Judaism in America it didn't start off on a very good foot. It started off with a lot of very assimilated Jews, and that's why when Jews started coming to America, they assimilated, because that was the culture of Jews then. They became they stopped keeping Shabbos. They became part like everybody else. And that went on, again, I'm skipping ahead, we'll go back to Eastern Europe in a second, but that went on all the way until a lot of great Jewish sages came to the American shores. For example, Reb Moshe Feinstein, one of the great halachic authorities of the previous generation, Aaron Kotler, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, great people came to the shores of the United States, and they sort of laid down the seeds for what America is today for the Jewish people, which is an incredible religious, in many parts of America, that is, which after Israel is the center of religious of religious Judaism. Right? But that only happened much later, because again, this culture of assimilation carried on when the Jews immigrated to America. Right? What was going on in Eastern Europe? Eastern Europe was the total opposite. Most Jews were actually in Eastern Europe at the time, around 5 million Jews. They were under the Tsar. The Tsars were terrible for the Jewish people. They instigated pogroms, decrees, terrible anti-Semitism, terrible persecution. On the other hand, the spirituality of the Jews flourished in a way. Many great movements started there. So we mentioned already the Hasidic movement, the Yeshiva movement. The great yeshivas of the time, started by Reb Chaim Volozhiner, who was a student of the Vilna Gaon, who we mentioned before, started great yeshivas in Volozhin. His yeshiva started in Mir. Great yeshivas, which sort of laid the seeds for what we have today, many, many yeshivas, you know, a system of learning for Jewish people that we have today was sort of started then. The Musar movement, started by Reb Yisrael Salanter, Muslim movement, which places an emphasis on learning Jewish ethics and then improving oneself, was also started there. Great things happened. Great growth for the Jewish people. Physically very bad, spiritually very good. On the other hand, obviously, there was also spiritual challenges. There was a group called the Maskilim, also in line with the Enlightenment, who tried to secularize the Jews, and they fought very hard. And they, unfortunately, did... were a little bit successful. But again, Judaism was pretty strong there at that point. Okay, so the truth is, we've sort of gone through everything, besides for two very important things. The Holocaust, and, I mean, obviously we've skipped many things, but just in a very general sense. The Holocaust and, of course, the establishment of the State of Israel. Both of these subjects need weeks to study. Obviously, when we talk about the Holocaust, there are, one can say, thousands of books written on it. And the establishment of the State of Israel is also an incredible subject to study with many, many great detail and many great stages and exactly what happened when. But just a couple of things to discuss. The Holocaust, of course, I mean, we all know this, but I guess it's important to discuss, was sort of the culmination, you can say, of all the persecution that we've been discussing till now. Everything that we discussed till now all happened in the Holocaust. Talking about pogroms, libels, not believing in propaganda about Jews. But of course, the Holocaust took it to a whole new level. It was a systematic murder of Jews with the intention literally to eradicate the entire Jewish nation. It was obviously the worst tragedy in our history, one can say. We all know 6 million Jews were murdered. And when we talk about the Holocaust, and we talk about all the persecution, the truth is, but throughout Jewish history, but especially the Holocaust, the question is always, you know, why, where was God, and all those type of things, right? So the truth is, the correct way to approach this is that there is no answer. You know, we have the famous story that God is right before Moshe Rabbeinu passed away. God shows Moses a vision of what's going to happen in all the future generations, and he sees the great sage Rabbi Akiva being combed to death alive. Being combed with iron combs to death. And Moshe Rabbeinu asks God, you know, this is one of the greatest sages, why is this happening to him? And God tells him, "Shtoik kach al machshava." Be quiet, this is what came up in my thoughts. In other words, there's no reason. There's no reason that I can explain to you. And the concept is that God is beyond logic. In other words, not everything has to make sense. And we understand that, so we don't always look for answers. It's emotionally difficult to accept. It's intellectually difficult to accept. One second, but when we understand that God is beyond reason, so there are certain things which Hashem does, which is beyond reason.
Excuse me. Can we think that there is a big plan that we don't know, and we'll never know, and we see little bits of this, the effects of this plan, and we never have the full picture?
Yeah, that is true.
That's true.
But that's another way of saying that we don't see the answer for this. Right, and yeah, you know, there's something that is beyond reason. We don't have any way of figuring out how this fits into the plan.
And that was explicitly said to Moses by Hashem.
Yeah.
What was the word?
Shtoik, be quiet. Kach ola b'machshava. This is what has come up in my thought. In other words, this is what I want.
Kach so.
Ola came up b'machshava in my thought.
Don't question it.
There's only two questions.
And that was the one instance that it was ever challenged. Why would we have this?
Well, it was the one instance, but it's a very general question. Yeah, it's a very general question. This is the answer.
My grandmother used to say, how do you say ask in Yiddish?
Freg?
Freg, God, Ashkar.
Yeah.
Must not ask the question.
The idea is like this, because when people start giving answers, the answers are not good answers anyway. So you don't gain anything by giving answers. The only thing we can say is that we don't understand, because it's something, and this is said especially about the Holocaust, because there was many persecutions, but this is something which is so beyond our understanding. How can such a thing happen? And there's questions on God, and there's questions on the world. Where was the world? Right? How can everyone be quiet? And all it's such a crazy thing. There's no good answer for it.
The world was prepared by all the other persecutions of so many centuries. This is how they accepted the Holocaust.
Yeah.
All the centuries of persecution of the Jewish people.
But still, to reconcile mentally, considering it contradicts entirely against keep mitzvahs, be a good Jew, have a good life,
yeah.
To then have on the flip side, the most horrific things can still happen in spite of keeping mitzvahs, being a good Jew, and in the event it does, we don't ask questions.
Correct.
Like that, it would be very difficult for the human.
Of course. Faith is very difficult.
To reconcile mentally.
Yeah, definitely. It's not easy. We'll put it this way. It makes sense that not everything makes sense. I mean, it's the fact that God... The fact that God is beyond logic, that itself is logical. God is infinite. Is totally beyond our understanding. The fact that, on the contrary, the fact that we can understand some things about God, that's unbelievable. God is infinite and we're finite. With our finite brains, it's impossible to understand the infinite.
I know, but if there's an explicit guidance, keep mitzvahs, be a good Jew, you will have a good life.
I get you. No, it doesn't make sense spiritually either.
Yeah.
Even within spiritual guidelines, it doesn't make sense. Because God defies that also. God is not defined by anything.
But that's an extension of it, saying in spite of it, that there's not always an answer, still believe, still...
Correct.
Mitzvahs.
Correct. Very difficult. I'm not saying it's easy.
Well, I would think in this time particularly, it would have been incredibly...
Incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. Yeah.
And was there an outcome of that, that a lot of Jewish people renounced their faith?
There was, on the one hand. On the other hand, what's unbelievable is you see Jews who came out of the Holocaust and still believed. There's a film. There's a documentary that...
What you believe that film would happen?
We watched it in Nefesh.
Look, it's something which is very... It's the biggest question.
Was there a segment of the Jewish community that didn't, that after the Holocaust said...
I don't know if it was like official movement as such. I'm sure there were people who doubted their faith afterwards, and that's, we can't blame them at all. We can't judge them at all. Some haven't
about, like, for example, Shabtai Tzvi, when he converted, the impact. So similarly, after the Holocaust,
I think that the effects of the Holocaust is not only the 6 million that died,
right,
which is obviously crazy, and there are no words to describe that, but it's the effects on the living as well, on every level, spiritually, psychologically. You know, you see families who are like third generations from Holocaust survivors, they're still affected by it. You know, it definitely traumatized us. I mean, I'm not going to deny that. I mean, we're still traumatized by it, right? There's nothing good about it, right? But again, the idea is, let's put it this way. At the end of the day, and this is not an answer, but at the end of the day, we're still here, and the Germans aren't.
Yeah. And the state, right? Of Israel.
And, which brings us to the next idea, correct. Which brings us to the next, perhaps one of the most greatest miracles of our time, which is the fact that we have Israel. The fact that Israel is under our control, the establishment of the state of Israel, was the greatest miracle, and I think still is the greatest miracle. I'll just, you know, this is something which we, this is things which we all know, but preparing for this, you know, reading about it, just go through the basic history of the establishment of the state of Israel. Down to the very first day when they read the Declaration of Independence, and five nations attacked a one-day-old state. Right? How did we come out of that? How did we come out of the Six-Day War? How did we come out of all the wars that Israel fought? How is Israel still around? And how is Israel flourishing, not only still around? Right? There's no explanation. That also has no explanation. Right? The fact that the Jewish people are around at all has no explanation. Because we're supernatural. We're beyond reason. The existence of the Jewish people is beyond reason. Right? That's it?
You mentioned in another lecture that if people say, well, does Israel should belong to the Jewish people, because God gave us...
Correct.
So that's the reason.
Yeah, 100%. But that's a supernatural reason. That's not a natural reason. Right, 100%. Yeah, obviously. God performed tremendous miracles for us by giving us the land of Israel back in our hands. There's nothing to talk about. Right? And of course, I mean, we could spend many, many classes on the history of Zionism and the process of how we got there. But the fact that we got there is an unbelievable miracle. It's a tremendous miracle.
Is there, obviously we've covered the chronology of history and sages and so forth, was there any that foresaw these things happening? Is that an element of the
Which things?
Just the Holocaust would happen, or the state of Israel. And was that a movement within the Jewish history of predictions?
It's cyclical, isn't it? In terms of persecution and...
Sorry, it was?
You're saying it was cyclical. We would have moments of...
Yeah, I mean, it's a cycle. Yeah, exactly. It's part of Jewish history.
In response to the vision of Dreiber Walls, is a prediction in the Torah.
For Tchias HaMesim, yeah. From Shiach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When the parasha that reads about the vision of dry bones coming together, senior to senior, bone to bone.
Yeah. Read it on Pesach. Chol my Pesach. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
This is a prediction.
Yeah. Yeah. Prediction. Yeah. So to sort of wrap this all up, one thing we see, and we see this again and again, we see two things throughout Jewish history. Number one, as we've been mentioning the whole time, our existence, the fact that we're still here, is totally supernatural, and there's no explanation for it. And another thing which we see is what kept us here, and that is our commitment to Torah learning and to practicing Torah. What kept the Jewish people together, even though we were spread out through the four corners of the earth, is the faith in one God, the commitment to one Torah, and the commitment to our traditions and values. That is the secret to Jewish survival, and that is what kept us going, which is our mission. The reason why we're still here is because we're not a nation which just happens to be here. We were a nation which was chosen for a certain purpose. And that purpose is to bring the world to its ultimate perfection, which is the next chapter of Jewish history, which is Mashiach, the ultimate redemption, where we'll all go to the land of Israel and God's presence will be revealed throughout the entire world. And what we have been working for, and what we've been persecuted for, and what we fought for, will actually materialize. So that's, in a nutshell, the entire Jewish history.
Amen.